Governor Holmes Norton, who is professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center, was appointed by President Carter as the first woman to chair the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. As EEOC chair, Professor Norton administered Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the Equal Pay Act, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, and Section 501 of the Rehabilitation Act, covering people with disabilities. These almost seem like ancient golden age legislation. She is an authority on labor force participation, anti-discrimination policy, family education, and poverty law. She was educated at Antioch College and Yale University, where she won both a law degree and a degree in American Studies. She co-authored Sex Discrimination in the Law, Causes and Remedies, and she is now at work on a book on the development and impact of anti-discrimination law and affirmative action remedies. Many of you know her from NPR, and many of you know her from the other talk shows in which she seems like a voice of reason over in a time of crisis. It's a great pleasure to introduce Eleanor Holmes Norton.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ellen, Carol, sisters all. It's a great pleasure to be once again at Barnard. It may well be, I think it is, that the last time I was here was in the early 70s when I was very pregnant and the women's movement was very young, and thus my commencement speech virtually wrote itself. It is not without reason that Simone de Beauvoir entitled one of her last essays, Feminism, Alive, Well, and in Constant Danger. Different and difficult issues confront women today. American feminists, if their search for full equality is to be successful, need to look at their own movement not only lovingly, as we must, but self-critically. Let me attempt such a self-critical feminist analysis this afternoon. Great movements differ from society's other activities because their raison d'etre is change, which must include change within movements themselves. If a movement is to weather phases of stalemate, setback, or resistance, it must think about itself, where it is going and where it has been. Bewilderment may result not only when there is reaction or opposition to progress, such as the kind we saw during this decade. It may come if we do not periodically reassess, rethink, and recreate change. In times that are changing rapidly, it is not enough to accept all that we have done as doctrine, static and forever true, simply pasting on what is new. I agree with the feminist philosopher Elizabeth Minock that you can't simply add the idea that the world is round to the idea that the world is flat. Isn't that wonderful? The woman thought about that. You go back and rethink the whole enterprise. The point is not, of course, to rethink our goals or ideals. Rather, we need to strive for the clarity of analysis that will help us to continue to advance and to live with the new complexity we ourselves have created. How should we think about women during a period when our achievements make us impatient with the great tasks that remain? The overriding challenge facing women's change today may well be whether we can sustain the momentum for change long enough to truly alter the status of a group so monumentally large and pervasive. Can we sustain and indeed increase the momentum so that we can accomplish the most ambitious task in human history, the advancement of half the world's population from subjugated status based on sex? Can we spread the movement for women's freedom to engage the majority of women in a world where most still live their lives as chattel? In the United States, the movement for women's freedom has traveled so fast, it will be challenged to continue and accelerate its own quick pace. Most movements languish for years before they capture the national imagination. This was true of the civil rights movement, which fought for 50 years after the founding of the Niagara movement that produced the NAACP, until the Brown decision opened the way for the final defeat of segregation. This was true of the labor movement, which struggled for 100 years before it was legitimated by the National Labor Relations Act. The path of the women's movement since the late 1960s has been different. The second feminist movement almost immediately caught fire. The movement quickly went from consciousness raising to hell raising, and the country went right along with it. This rapid acceptance occurred in no small part because the civil rights movement paved the way in two fundamental respects. It made movement struggle once again an acceptable course for Americans, and it made equality an imperative for the nation. Thus, the fast ascent of the second feminist movement contrasted with the slow crescendo of the first. Suffrage came only after almost 75 years of tedious struggle. And the first women's movement disintegrated after suffrage was won in 1920. With it went the momentum that had cracked professional and other barriers. Without it, a resurgence of attitudes favoring women's traditional role took hold. The feminist period of the picket sign and the petition succumbed to the day of the flapper. The career woman proves threatening. The flapper, even with her greater social and sexual freedom, became the symbol of the age because she posed no threat to the view of woman as essentially sexual. The woman seeking work and greater equality was not to reemerge until our time. The decline of feminism and of women's rights after suffrage could happen again. Today, there are signs here and there of fatigue, of disquiet, of uncertainty of direction, of the language of post-feminism. Yet despite the emergence of a fierce opposition to women's change, the insistent momentum continues. Nevertheless, a new generation of issues and conditions inevitably raises new questions. The most important of these may be whether the women's struggle has crested, or whether we can continue to move out of the millennia, which have defined gender as the most powerful determinant in life. To live beyond their moment of ascendancy, to live to get the whole job done, great movements must reinvent themselves. To sustain themselves, movements must not only grow, they must change. This is not only because the times inevitably change, it is because we ourselves have changed the times. Thus, we must react in part to our own history. That history is characterized by increasing pluralism of thought and ideas. For the first time, we are seeing the development of quite diverse and sometimes contrary tendencies in feminist thought. Some of it, I think, wrongheaded, but I learn from all of it and would want none of it suppressed. I differ with feminists who have joined the far right in favoring censorship as the cure for sexually explicit material, for example. Blacks have defeated the outrageous stereotypes that were commonplace without the sacrifice of the right to speak and write. Indeed, the First Amendment has been the most important weapon blacks have had in this country. It enabled them to speak and to organize against racism. If it had been weakened, blacks themselves would have been the first to suffer from the harmful precedent, and racism would still be the official American doctrine. As women have learned from so much from the civil rights movement, let them also learn that to dilute the right to speak and write and organize is to sever the vital lifeline to struggle for unempowered groups. I disagree also with the feminist historian who testified for Sears in a notorious EEOC case brought while I was at the commission, but tried a few years ago after I had left. She testified that women's acculturation, rather than Sears' employment patterns, were responsible for male and female job patterns at Sears. EEOC's expert, another feminist historian, testified that visible job patterns determine women's job aspirations. EEOC lost the case on a number of technical legal grounds. But the conflicting testimony of feminist historians caused great controversy in the feminist academic community. As such differences emerge publicly for the first time, they should be seen not as intolerable splits, but as the emergence of conflicting lines of thought that is inevitable in a giant and diverse movement. When a movement relates to half the population in a country as diverse as this, it is impossible to require a conformity to a single worldview in order for participants to count themselves in. If feminism is to succeed and spread, it will have to behave like a giant multicolored umbrella that keeps expanding, inviting those who pass to come in out of the rain. Not like a bus shelter with room only for those going my way. The group is too large, the paths necessarily diverse, even discordant. Those who favor women's change may not always be prepared for this pluralism because of the remarkable homogeneity that characterized the movement until the most recent years. That unity was the characteristic of a young movement just discovering itself and its ideas. The common grievances were so conspicuous that there was no thought of the ultimate inevitability of differences. The women's movement galvanized a consensus on the most basic issues, and as a result, shortly grew from a small, initially middle-class, white movement into one including minority and poor women, the majority of men, according to the polls, and of course the politicians, which means everybody. There is, of course, both risk and opportunity in pluralism in movement activity. There is always the danger of destructive factionalism. Tolerance, discipline, and leadership are necessary to avoid self-involved sectarianism and balkanization. For a pluralism of ideas also affords the life-saving opportunity for regeneration with which a movement cannot make the changes necessary for it to continue to grow. Thus, the risk of pluralism and even contradictory ideas must be taken, or a movement will lose its vitality and become frozen in time, embalmed in the slogans of yesterday. We accept and learn even from those among us with whom we must necessarily disagree. I have learned from those who want pregnant women to be given a preference in returning to their jobs, while men returning from illness may be fired. We feel uneasy about treating pregnancy in this special way while allowing employers to ignore the necessity of male family members to continue to work after an illness. We instinctively understand that Felice Schwartz's recent Harvard Business Review article means not only a return to official second-class status in the workplace, but that we will never achieve the wholesale change we deserve if we settle for a special and diminished role for women. Yet disagreement over special leaves for women only and similar issues is not necessarily divisive. It can sharpen the search for acceptable remedies. For example, the notion of maternity leave for women, but no leave at all for men, directly led to or stimulated the now pending family medical and leave bill that would allow both men and women to get their jobs back after an illness. Similar divergence of thought beginning to emerge on a range of issues is neither unfeminist or unwise. Ultimately, these diverse ideas will help clarify issues and produce the necessary remedies. All the thinking we can muster on the perplexing new and difficult issues facing women needs to come out. Are full-time, 40-year careers the best way to organize work for women or for men in the 21st century? What is the appropriate response to Sylvia Hewlett's critique that the women's movement has focused insufficiently on the problems of working mothers and children? How should family life be rethought to take account of the new problems that confront families? And they are awful. The division of responsibility and the organization of a fruitful family existence in this new age of working parents. Divorce, its often serious effects on children and its effect on poverty among women, and more, much more. If the women's movement is to continue to grow and spread, it must hear its own issues out and change as change becomes indicated. Otherwise, women will neither march with history nor make it. And we must make more history. Most of the world's women have not been touched by women's change. Women are 2 out of every 3 illiterates in the world, and the number is rising, not falling. Only 1/3 of the world's women have access to any form of contraceptive information or device. Women are the world's principal water haulers, fuel gatherers, and food producers. We are left to wonder what it is that men do in the world. The International Women's Decade Pride opened the eyes of the world to practices that range from pristine to sophisticated, as each country subordinates its women in its own special way. In this country, we have advanced beyond most others despite the failure of the ERA, a failure we shall see reversed. In little more than 20 years, we have won important new legislation. We have won significant education and job advancement. We have won the right to choose or reject abortion. We have won the elimination of almost all gender-based law. And we have won increased representation at every level of government. By building an open and expansionist movement, we have attracted women who were found only sparsely among the early feminists of the 1960s. Today, small towns and hidden suburbs do not always articulate feminist ideas, but the wives work. The girls have an expanded view of their possibilities, and the men and boys have accepted the trade winds of change. Such has been the wholesale embrace of women's change by millions of Americans. It is particularly noteworthy that the necessity for women's change has been so roundly accepted by Black women, even though they must continue to confront racial problems facing Blacks as a whole. The troublesome question of race is inevitably present in the women's movement as elsewhere. The movement has not always been free of fault or criticism on race. Still, no American movement has done more to try to understand its relationship to minorities and to directly relate to their concerns. In the history of American movements, it will be difficult to find another for which the elimination of racism has been a determined goal from its inception. The National Women's Political Caucus, in its founding statement of purpose in July 1971, declared, "We believe that women must take action to unite against sexism, racism, institutional violence, and poverty." Yet the issue of race still steps forward on occasion, sometimes because of insensitivity in the movement, sometimes because of hypersensitivity among minorities. These small tensions will be with us until our national racial wounds, the deepest our society has known, are fully healed. In the meantime, we must not allow the inevitable breaches to undermine the overriding community of interest that minorities and women share. Mutual suspicion about who is getting the most attention or the most affirmative action shatter our unity of purpose. A divided constituency aids those who would dismantle the remedies and programs that both minorities and women have struggled to achieve. Affirmative action is a classic case. Neither women nor minorities hold the jobs both seek in America. The excluded groups are struggling not for the opportunities that become available to one another, but for the jobs and places monopolized by others. Each time minorities and women act as if the competition were among them, they remove just that much pressure for fairness from government and employers. The concern sometimes expressed that the expansion of women in the job market will hurt minorities is a case in point. The explosion of woman power in the labor market has been overwhelmingly in low-paid, sex-stereotype jobs where women compete with one another more often than they compete, much more often than they compete with minority men. Black women, for example, at least those who work, are at wage parity with white women today because both are locked in clerical and other women's jobs. The fact is that black women could achieve wage parity with white women despite their social and educational disadvantages is the best evidence of the tenacity of sex stereotyping in education and jobs and of sex discrimination itself. Comparable Worth caught fire precisely because it addresses wage discrimination in sex stereotype jobs held overwhelmingly by the majority of women of every race and background where minority men seldom seek or desire work. Here is where leadership from women and leadership from minorities is essential. Open communication about differences, efforts to heal them, and joint strategies will keep the cobwebs of suspicion from accumulating to divide us. Joint action for mutual advantage is what strengthens and typifies our coalition. That coalition claims noble antecedents. Two great Americans, two great Black Americans, Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, who joined their resolute abolitionism with a fervent feminism. On the question of the necessity for both race and sex equality, Sojourner Truth would brook no compromise. When the tricky question of whether the 15th Amendment should be supported, if it enfranchised only men, she took the position that limiting the vote to men would mean, and I quote her, men would be the masters over the women and would be just as bad as it was before, end quote. Throughout his life, Douglass spoke and acted as a dedicated feminist. He called himself a woman's rights man. He was the only man to play a prominent role at Seneca Falls, and he was a frequent and major speaker at the other important women's rights conventions and meetings of his day. When the time came to change the name of his paper, he refused to call it the Brotherhood because he said, and I quote him, it implies the exclusion of the sisterhood, end quote. The headlines carrying news of Douglass's death in Europe and America called him both the greatest Negro leader and a friend and champion of women. Today, with women of so many backgrounds walking under the feminist banner, we have outlived Simone de Beauvoir's observation in The Second Sex that the free woman is just being born. Today, she has become a force. In the process, the wonderful coherence of our initial drive against sexism has scattered as we have cracked open the most stony impediments to equality. What remains is an untidy assortment of what used to be, what is becoming, and what has just been formed. In our boldness, we have swept away the most audacious brands of sexism. What remains is less monumental, but it is equally great. We will not sustain the energy and the imagination to confront the next barriers without the treasure of our diversity. For what remains to be accomplished is necessarily the most difficult. The barriers that have fallen were the least sturdy and the most vulnerable. We now approach the most weighty and complicated, encouraging freer and more equal private roles for women and men in family responsibilities to match greater equality emerging in work roles, establishing a national support system for working parents with educational childcare at its center, reversing job and wage disparities that have stubbornly resisted change, preparing for a family and work life of the future that will be markedly different from anything we have experienced, reforming the view of women as of lesser value when they are done with child raising and no longer young, to match the continuing value society places on men into old age. The list is longer still. It is lined with at once the toughest and the most delicate tasks we have ever faced. All of this amounts to a task for both innovative public policy and for rethinking ancient private habits. The women's movement must lead this effort, just as it raised the consciousness of the nation two decades ago and led a series of profound changes in the legal status of all women and in the actual status of millions. A movement which thinks critically not only about the continuing inequality in our society, but also about its own role in bringing about change, will surely succeed in its quest for full equality. Thank you very much.
Carol Bellamy, one of the founders of the first feminist law firm in the United States, has occupied many of the places some of us only think about. And I want to say parenthetically that more and more are thinking about some of the places that she's occupied, namely electoral office. As a member of the New York City Council, she continued to mobilize her community and to have her community support her in her electoral efforts. Many of us contributed our energies in the hopes of getting her elected mayor, but alas, they weren't enough at that time. As a person who has wide-ranging experience in grassroots movements, in elective office, and in private industry, she has a most unique perspective, which she has agreed to share with us today. It's with great pleasure that I introduce Carol Bellamy.
Thank you very much. You know you're getting old when people introduce you as one who has held many different positions. I was thinking, actually, that Ellen and Ellie and I are all, by at least training, lawyers. Eleanor still even has a vague relationship to it, being a professor, although she was clearly my candidate for cabinet secretary this year, and that's how we should have been introducing her today. And for any of you who are as old as I am, who remember a time in the city when we cared that that racial tension be reduced and human rights still were important in this city, you will remember that Ellie led us as head of the Commission on Human Rights as well, leadership that we desperately need at this point. And Ellen Futter, well, Ellen has done a whole bunch of things, too. Ellen, you don't look 100, as I said before, and I think it's done a wonderful job. In any case, yes, I've held all these different positions. I've never been able to hold a job for very long. I've been in elective office in government. I've practiced law. I'm now doing investment banking. I said to somebody at lunch, I only have to be in real estate, and then I will have been in every sleazy profession that one can be in. And then maybe my mother will finally convince me to get a real job. So it's, I figure I have several more professions in me. Well, I'm delighted to be here. I was a little worried. I got up this morning, I thought to myself, I haven't talked to anybody at Barnard in a while. I don't even know whether this is still happening today, but I thought I'd come by and see. And also, I thought, as only a kid from Brooklyn would think, I said, what a schmuck, Bellamy, you're on a panel with Eleanor Norton. Now that is, I mean, that's really a crazy thing to do for those of us who are longtime wonderful fans of Ellie, although I complain that these days I have to listen to her reasonable thinking at 6:15 in the morning. If any of you are NPR groupies like I am, I travel a lot and I find myself in weird places in this country, not international travel, all domestic and pretty, not very jet-setty either. So my anchor is NPR. It's those same voices every morning telling us, Silvia Poggioli from Italy, and telling us where they are, but hearing Eleanor is always a wonderful thing. In any case, so I went back and I looked at this, I said, Scholar and Feminist Conference, this is supposed to be substantive. There are going to be a bunch of those academics here. I wasn't sure who was going to be here, and I thought, well, that isn't me. I mean, I was in government, and as my wonderful friend Karen Burr, I was in elective office, not even appointive. I'm going to be talking a little of both. Appointive, you're supposed to have some substance. In elective, there are a whole bunch of things you're supposed to do, which I appreciate, but as I said, my wonderful friend Karen Burstein used to say, still says, actually, when you're in elective office, you've got to be good for 3 minutes on every subject, but don't scratch us for the fourth. So I thought I would just be a little, and then I looked at my topic, which I suspect I discussed with Ellen like months ago. I thought to myself, it was one of those days where somebody called and said, would you speak? He said, yes, how's this topic? Sounded great. I thought, it makes no sense to me, this topic. When I finally focused on it. So what I thought I'd like to do, actually, is talk a little bit. For those of you who think, well, politics, or those politicians, or whatever you think, I want to talk a little bit about, or some statistics from some studies about who really, you know, what's the picture of who actually is in elective office today, or a point of office. I'm going to throw out some statistics. And I say that because you may think, I always run into people that say, oh, I wouldn't touch politics with a 10-foot pole. Then they go back to their academic institutions where there's more politics than the New York City Council. Or wherever it is. I mean, you know, I sit there and say, they could teach us something. Or in their foundation, or in their grassroots community organization. And so I wanted, since my liberal friends always thought I was too conservative, and my conservative friends always thought I was too liberal, I want to at least describe a little bit who I think is holding office or being appointed of office. Because however you want to bring about change, some of the change makers are these people. And I don't think they can be ignored. Moreover, more of you ought to become these people. So that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about. So it's, for those really thinkers in this audience, if you want to go get some coffee or something, feel free, because this isn't going to be one of these like intellectual texts that you might be used to. Since Eleanor mentioned Seneca Falls, I thought I'd start there. I thought I'd put it in some perspective since we're in New York today. You don't have to be from New York, but I always think, if you know me, you've probably heard this story, and it is a true story, I'm told. I paraphrase it, but back in late 1860s, I guess it is, when a group of women, and as you heard, some men, mostly women, gathered together to usher in what I consider to be the beginning of the modern feminist movement, as they met in Seneca Falls. We hold these truths to be self-evident, reads the Seneca Falls Declaration of Women's Independence, that all men and women are created equal. And then this declaration went on to list a whole series of areas in which it was thought that women were not treated equally, starting first with, as you might have expected, the fact that women were not granted the right to vote at that point. In fact, as you may recall, it took 70 years, from the time women first petitioned for the right to vote to until they got the right to vote. And the arguments for those, any of you have even spent like 5 minutes thinking about ERA and listening to those arguments were, if you give women the right to vote, it will break up the family. That old famous, wonderful argument. Well, there are some who would argue that women having won the right to vote has neither realized the fears of the opponents nor, in some cases, the potential of the proponents. But I think that I hope that's beginning to change. So it started off with women not having the right to vote. It talked about the fact that women were not treated equally in marriage. You know, in marriage, the two become one, and the one is the man. It talked about the inequity in terms of the value of women's work. And you know how far we've come on that. I mean, you know, every year or so, Rand Corporation comes out with another report that says, oh, have you noticed it's not 68 cents to the dollar that men earn? We're all the way up to 70 cents, which means that we only need about another, 100 years. Next time Barnard celebrates its 100th year, we'll be at 95 cents, women, what they're earning on what men earn. We actually do better in the Northeast on an average, actually, women's salaries vis-a-vis men. I mean, nowhere near the dollar to dollar. We do a little better than the rest of the country. I believe that's because Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer's salaries are both in our, whatever. So we do a little better here. But we're still, how far we've come on that. We're still pay equity. First of all, we can't even figure out what to call pay equity, comparable worth, all these. We need a movement that can figure out better ways of describing these things. So I'm looking at the great leader in the area of fighting pay equity. Same thing with, I used to hate the term displaced homemaker, which was a wonderful concept, but I always felt like you opened the door of your closet and out fell this displaced homemaker. In any case. So it went on to list all these areas. And so that was the declaration. So when I first read about this, actually, I will tell you, having put down all these academics, the first time I heard this story was brought to me by my chief of staff when I was president of the city council, Ellen Chesler, who was an academic. And about to finish what I think will be an extraordinary book on Margaret Sanger. In any case, she brought this story. And she said, having read about this, she wondered what happened with this declaration. For those of you who realize I'm still on the 1860s and wonder whether you'll get to the next, I'll try and move on. It turned out that the organizers of this organization, maybe it was a little earlier than the 1860s. Anyway, they submitted it to the New York State Legislature. Well, I served for 5 years as a state senator, and so I was not shocked to find out that it took them 11 years to review and report on this petition. And the Judiciary Committee, the history book tells us, it doesn't say whether it was the Senate or the Assembly, reported a Mr. Foote was chosen to chair this committee, F-O-O-T-E. Again, this is the true part of it. I mean, this is all true. I'm paraphrasing, but... And Mr. Foote was chosen to be the main reviewer of this report because he was the member of the committee who had been married the longest. So it was assumed that he would understand just what it was the ladies wanted. And Mr. Foote said, women always have the warmest places in the winter, the coolest places in the summer. They always have the best seats in the carriages and sleighs. Remember when this was being done. A woman's dress costs 3 times that of a gentleman. And given the prevailing fashion of the day, a woman takes up 3 times as much space in the world as a man. If there is any inequality or oppression, concluded Mr. Foote, surely the gentlemen are the sufferers. They, however, have not petitioned for redress, having doubtless made up their minds to yield to their inevitable destiny. So that is about 100 years ago, since we're celebrating the centennial, and that's just in our own state of New York. This great, wonderful, progressive, liberal state. The rest of the world thinks we are. They should know about this state. So we've come a long way from then, but how far have we come? Well, I was doing a little reading, a book about women in politics in 1968. Gruberg observed, and I'm going to quote, women have little part in the government of most states other than through their right to vote. Men are the movers, women are the ornaments. They have been accorded token recognition. Their appointments have usually clustered around certain activities regarded as women's areas. Those dealing with juveniles, school affairs, health, welfare, and libraries. Men have to be reminded to appoint women. Ordinarily, males do not think of females for government positions. And as for those of you, again, who may be students of all this, may recall, it was around that time that Jean Kirkpatrick wrote her really seminal book on women in politics, a traditional past where the women in politics tended to be women who had been married, raised their children, been active in local clubs or organizations, children left, and they wanted to do something. They thought about running for office. Their highest office they thought they could run for was state legislature, and they tended to run and didn't seek leadership positions. Now, you will learn from me that I don't happen to think that the highest offices in this country are Washington. I think from both parties, they wouldn't know a balanced budget if it walked up and bit them. But we do have this pecking order idea that the people are smartest in Washington, next smart at state, and bimbos at the local level. I don't happen to think that's so, but there was a kind of this limited perception. For any of you who may notice Jean Kirkpatrick's book, you will see that it was one of the people who wrote a little blurb on the cover of the book, by the way, urging people to buy the book, was Bella Abzug. It's always one of my favorites. Well, that brought us up to the 70s. I actually first ran for office in 1972. I was thinking 17 years ago, my God, and Liz Holtzman and I and a couple other people. So time has passed. 1984, Jerry Ferraro was the vice presidential candidate, and whatever one thinks of that election, the fact is that was just a major breakthrough because you had a woman as a member of the ticket of a major party. And that was extraordinary. So where are we today? Well, now I'm going to do a little test. Ask you some questions. You can try and think of these. And I'm sorry to do this, deviate a little bit from a written text, but just to go over, throw out some numbers. I want to talk very briefly or a little test in terms of women in elective office, and then talk a little bit about women in public office. We now have in Congress, actually, the U.S. Congress, in 89, more women than ever before. There are 535 members of Congress, 100 senators, 435 members of the House of Representatives. Any idea how many are women now? 26. I hear 35, I hear 26. Well, actually, for a long time, it was just 23. Remember, we could never get past that. In the old days, you only got elected if your husband had been there, and then you got elected. It was only a few years ago we started getting elected on our own right. Didn't mean that the women who were elected because their husbands had been there were bad. It's just that was, or their husbands or brothers. Well, actually, for those of you who even read the paper last week, your 26 was almost close. It was 27 until a week ago. We just elected another woman, Jill Long from Indiana. You know what the fact is? It's those Midwest states that keep sneaking in and electing women these days. You know, they think the crazies, you know, California and New York, they think they're the places that send all these people. We went for years for a while, having had a number of women in Congress with no one. Now we have two. But we're actually now up to 27. So we're moving. But let me explain how many that is. That's 5% of Congress. A total, actually, of 126 women have served in Congress. Now, no woman of color has ever served in the United States Senate. How many women of color do you think may have served in the House of Representatives? One, two, five, I hear. Seven. Five black women, two Asian American, Asian Pacific women. First black woman to serve in Congress, again, lest we think we went back too far, was Shirley Chisholm. One of our representatives, and remember those days we had Shirley Chisholm and Bella Abzug and Liz Holtzman all, I mean, it was enough to knock your socks off. Shirley was elected in 68, served until 83. Four other black women have served in the House. Yvonne Braithwaite Burke from California, Barbara Jordan from Texas, Katie Hall from Indiana, she was there from 82 to 85, and Curtis Collins, who's from Illinois, who is there now. Collins is the only black woman serving in Congress in 89. Patsy Mink, 65 to 77, first Asian Pacific American woman to serve in the House. Patricia Saiki from Hawaii is the second. Here's one of my favorites. There are three women governors serving in 89. I remember when we actually had one, and then it was a great year when we had 100% increase. We moved up to two. And now we're at three. Actually, the three women, Madeline Cunin from Vermont, maybe you know her. She's wonderful. The problem is she has to run every 2 years, but she's just superb, really. She's just great. Kay Orr from Nebraska, remember that race? Now, that was one of these. Be prepared. Two women running against each other in Nebraska for governor. I mean, now that, you know, would just... it's a wonder Nebraska didn't entirely clean out of people that year. It was just, I mean, Helen Bousalis on the Democratic side and Kay Orr, and they were great. And, you know, there would be the New York Times. God forbid women should even have a position of vague power at the New York Times. Having to write these articles with these people from Nebraska saying things like, hey, they're not bad, you know, they could be governor. So Kay Orr from Nebraska and Rose Mofford. Rose of the hair style. I really love that hair. Have you seen that hair? Rose Mofford from Arizona, who actually was elected as Secretary of State and then when Meekham was impeached, but Mofford says she's going to run. So two were actually elected on their own. Now, how many, what's the total number of women who've served as governors? I'll stop with the numbers shortly, but it's interesting to know some. Nine, actually. Now, let's talk about a couple of these. Eight Democrats, one Republican. The first woman governor was Nellie Tylo Ross from Wyoming. She replaced her deceased husband. Then Ma Ferguson from Texas and Lurleen Wallace from Alabama. Now, a quick word about Ma Ferguson. Ann Richards likes to tell a story about Ma Ferguson, who served twice, actually, because her husband went to jail. He didn't get deceased. He went to jail. So if you ever go to the Texas Capitol, you'll see Ma is on twice in her little pictures. She said, if English was good enough for Jesus Christ, it's good enough for us in Texas. So, it's really great. First woman governor, again, to bring you up to date, the first woman governor elected in her own right was Ella Grasso, who served, I think, very well in, elected in 74, re-elected in 78, in Connecticut, stepped down for health reasons, as you know, died shortly after of cancer. Dixie Lee Ray from Washington was governor, 77 to 81. Martha Lane Collins from Kentucky, 83 through 87. And now I think the exciting thing, if you want to know what's happening out there, is 1990. Watch it if any of you are interested in politics. Because the exciting thing in this country is how many women are either running or potentially running for governor. I'm not one who says you just go out and support a woman for a woman's sake, but they're interesting characters. Ann Richards in Texas, Dianne Feinstein in California, Evelyn Murphy in Massachusetts, all of them are very legitimate candidates. I mean, we're not talking, I mean, they may or may not win. These are tough states. You're talking, and a lot of bucks to get elected. But maybe Marlene Johnson, the lieutenant governor of Minnesota. And in the future, I think you'll see at least in the next 4, 5, 6 years, Colorado, Louisiana, so it's an interesting time. One final one in this one. Two last. In mid-86, women held about 17% and 18% of appointed positions in governor's cabinets, because I now want to get to some of the appointed stuff. The largest percentage of these women held positions, now if you don't get this one right, in what are the following areas? Area one is the finance, budget, taxation, revenue area. Two is human rights, civil rights, women's rights, and three is health, social services. Anyone want to guess? Health and social services, you're right. About 7% of women cabinet officials were in the finance, budget, taxation. But that's an interesting thing to watch at state levels because they're getting to be more state treasurers who are women. And they may or may not be strong offices, but people think they're strong offices. So if they're smart women, they go out and make something out of the office, even though it may not have any power at all. I mean, it's like city council president, actually. It may have no power at all, but you just go out and you try and make something out of the office. And finally, and since 69, the number of women state legislatures has more than quadrupled. What percentage of state legislatures in this country are women? Legislators, I should say. Well, it's about 17%. And the reason I raise that, because under the wise President Reagan, we had the new federalism, which beside screwing up the economy in this country, pushed any number of really substantive types of policy areas to state and local government, which is where I think some of the very creative work is going on in this country today. And so you do increasingly have women at both the state and local level. At the local level, you have increasing number of women because they never paid women anything at the local. They never paid, I should say, council members much to speak of in most city councils. And so guys used to do it and work their regular job and then work as a council member. But people demand more of their council members across this country these days, whether it's Lincoln, Nebraska, or New York City. And so you don't get paid very much generally, and you now have to work really hard. So women are taking those positions. And at the state legislative level, there are more and more women. And unlike the past where they just got elected, they are increasingly moving into positions of more authority. OK, those are some of my statistics. Now, let me talk a little bit about just a little bit more of the makeup, and then I'll conclude. Women, now you get a sense of appointed people, of elected people. Just a couple statistics of women appointed based on some studies done at Rutgers, at Eagleton Institute, some other places. Women state cabinet level appointees, I'm going to talk about that, because the last time we even had a vaguely decent number of federal employees in the cabinet, or even in government, was in the Carter administration. So there's not a lot to pick from. There are only so many positions that Liddy Dole can hold in this country. We could have little cutouts of Liddy Dole, and she can go from position to position to position, but there are only so many. But to give you some idea of at least of the makeup, women state cabinet level appointees, like state appointees overall, have strong education and professional backgrounds. Most of them actually have a majority, I should say, of women appointees. Now I'm not talking about elected, I'm talking about appointees, have postgraduate degrees. Although women state cabinet level appointees come into office with less prior government experience than do appointees overall, they are as or more likely than appointees overall to have had other types of political experience. And it's interesting, they tend to have had political experience at the federal level. Many women appointees were inspired, and I make this point, again, based on studies, show this consistently. Many women appointees were inspired and assisted by other women. Nearly one of every 10 women appointees report that the person most influential in bringing about her appointment was a woman. Among women appointees who received assistance from an organization other than a political party in obtaining their appointments, over one-third received assistance from women's groups. Among women appointees whose political involvement was inspired by role models, almost 50% had female role models. Women, another factor, women state cabinet level appointees are more likely, who's here? Women state cabinet level appointees are more likely than state cabinet level appointees overall to take the dreaded L word, position on issues, and feminist stands on issues. For example, just to use a couple, 80% of women appointees compared with 60% of state employees overall support ratification of the ERA, just to use as a test, and whether they are serving in the administration of Democratic or Republican governors, 9 out of every 10 women appointees compared with 3/4 of appointees overall oppose a constitutional amendment prohibiting abortion. And just a little bit demographically, while a majority of women appointees and appointees overall are married, women are less likely to be married and are more likely than all appointees to be single, separated, or divorced. 67% of female appointees compared with 85% of appointees overall are married. Actually, you can't win either way. I'll tell you, if you're single, man or woman, they want to know generally, why aren't you married? Okay? But then if you are married, if you're a man, that's great. You're married, settled down, that's wonderful. If you're a woman, then they want to know, why are you leaving your children to go serve in office? If you're unmarried, they think you're crazy. And if you're married, they want to know, you're going to Albany, you're leaving your kids at home, nobody's going to take care of them. So women can't win either way in that. But in any case, demographically, slightly fewer women married, or more single, separated, or divorced. Among appointees who are or were married, women are more likely than appointees overall to have no children or fewer children. And women appointees are younger on the average than appointees in general. 46% of women compared with 28% of appointees overall are under the age of 40. Some final comments since I had to go back to my topic. It said similarities, so I called Karen. I said, Karen, what is this topic? What are the similarities? So we struggled a little bit. So this, in no particular order, here are some similarities that we decided that might mark both women in, and then I'll give you a couple differences, women in elective office and women in appointive office, in no particular order. One, impatience. Two, wanting to do good, whatever that means. It's a different definition for everybody, but wanting to do good. Three, a willingness to risk criticism, risking failing, risking it again. Next, to some degree, and it differs, a need for the limelight. Not unimportant. I give it, for those, I did, for those, my first year, I'm now 4 years out of public office. I mean, it's a mayoral election again this year. You remember, it was 4 years ago that the voters elected me to go to the private sector. Well, I was about my first year out of office, people would stop me all the time and they'd say, well, do you miss it? It was the same question came up all the time. And I kind of had my stock answer, which was that, yeah, I missed parts of it. I didn't miss all of it. And I particularly missed the public policy stuff because that's the interesting stuff. I don't care what you do in the private sector. It's just not as interesting in public policy. And that used to satisfy everybody. But I remember running into Liz Carpenter speaking about Texans. They're all funny. Remember Liz Carpenter who, and I gave her my stock answer and she said, honey, I'd miss the applause. So having told you that there is, that one of the similarities are impatience, wanting to do good, willingness to risk criticism, need for the limelight. And it may differ a little bit in terms of elective office and point of office. And a point of office, you may say, oh, no. Well, to some degree, you have to not be in the limelight, but to some degree, there is some limelight there as well. I think most, particularly given the inequities out there today, are not entirely infected by today's greed factor. Or in other words, unless you're a total crook, and there's no we women have no monopoly on goodness and justice in the public sector. Unless you're a total crook, you're not going to get rich in government. So that's to be understood. Action-oriented, I think. Generally, a person, whatever your philosophical bent, generally a person with some merit. I would even call kind of people in the public side kind of extraordinary, but I put quotes around that. Generally a person of some merit, but also probably a person who's had luck, good timing, and may occasionally have connections. And as I find, and in conclusion on that part, no monopoly, we don't really have a monopoly on goodness and justice and truth. Differences. Well, I think there are some differences. Elected official basically is there to do that 3 minutes on every subject. Now, I'm not putting it down. I mean, the articulator of policy, uses the bully pulpit, sets the policy agenda, hopefully can inspire, can lead. And there are all different ways to inspire and lead. I mean, you know, we don't all have to, some of us are vaguely literate, some of us are not. But there are all different ways. The appointed person is more the manager. I'm not talking about the green visor, but somebody who, in a sense, is the implementer of the policy. Constrained to some degree by the appointing authority, but the best appointees are able to manipulate the appointing authority. Or as I used to say when I was a state legislature, the smart lobbyists are the ones who didn't go home when the legislature was out of session, because they understood that the elected officials may pass the laws, but it was the people that wrote the regulations that really implemented the laws. Well, so those are some of my comments. And I want to discuss the individuals and the personalities a little bit, because while I celebrate and I congratulate kind of the substance of thinking about how what policy exists out there today, what ought to exist, how we ought to change policy, that some of the change agents, although they are not just the people in appointive and elective office. When I was in the Peace Corps, I remember learning, lesson one probably was, go into your community and find out who the change maker is, who's the change agent. And the change agent may not be the mayor of the community or may not be the head of the Chamber of Commerce. I mean, you should have seen the community in Guatemala. They didn't have a Chamber of Commerce where I went, But some of the change agents clearly are these women. And So just some final comments. We in this, we are lucky in this country because we do not have, you know, we don't necessarily have barriers to political participation that exist in some other places for women. So we have an opportunity, a great opportunity to achieve equal participation for women in our political structure, and I think we need to do that. More women in public life may not immediately turn swords into plowshares, but women do bring a different and diverse set of life experiences to the process. And for a democracy to be truly representative, it is only just that we be equally represented. There is much that needs to be done, and there are not enough political voices to speak out. Disarmament, the environment, children in poverty, new voices need to be heard. I encourage women to reach for the highest levels possible in their own political, that's a small p, whatever, however we define political aspirations, and simultaneously to continue to be role models for the next generation. Because women do make a difference in public policy. So when women become political equals in the exercise of power at all levels, we, for the first time, will have taken full responsibility for our own lives and for the lives of those who share life with us. That, in my view, is true equality. I thank you very much.
I want to thank the speakers this afternoon and this morning, and I also want to thank again the staff of the Center for Research on Women, Ruth Farmer, who's just leaving the room to do more work, Bernita Dorch, Tracy Strasser, Kim Cooperman, without whom this conference would never have taken place. And I want to thank all of you who come back year after year and for your participation. And I send you forth to the various plenaries and welcome you to come to the reception, which will immediately follow the plenaries. Thank you very much.